I'm Joanne Wilson, and this is Positively Gotham Gal. Real, honest, and meaningful conversations with women entrepreneurs about their approach to life, business, and everything in between.
Frances Burnett is an architect, interdisciplinary artist, and most importantly, driven educator who currently serves as the president of Pratt Institute. We got together over Zoom to discuss the future of a liberal arts education and innovation and learning models.
Hey, how is everybody today?
How are you?
Oh, my. I'm telling you, today I think I've lost it on the COVID situation.
What's going on? Anything new?
No, you know, today I just kind of got up and I'm just like, I'm so sick of this shit.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, you better take a deep breath because it's going to be around for a little bit longer.
Yes, I know.
You know, it's funny because either I have some kind of mental trap, but it, you know, there's so many things that I'm glad I'm not doing anymore. So that it's, in fact, and again, part of it is being in the place I am where there's so much aspiration and hope. You know, when you have young people and faculty members who are willing to take on these kind of learning possibilities, it's remarkable. Everyone's exhausted. I know that.
Sure.
That's the hard part, I think. And I have it very easy. You know, my kids are grown up and I don't have a four-year-old and a six-year-old I'm trying to teach.
I don't either. Thank God.
You know,
these parents, I mean,
Oh my God.
I can't even imagine. And also, these people in the public school system, and it's just like, oh, by the way, tomorrow, don't think about going to work because we're closed.
I know. It's like a zillion snow days when you're supposed to be still shoveling the snow.
Yeah, no, it's really hard. So anyway,
yeah.
Let's move on to better things. So did you always know that you were going to be, you know, going to architect and design?
Yeah. So the answer is no. I grew up in really what here would be considered, you know, sort of moderate income, low income housing, four-story block buildings, no vegetation, very little. So I had no aesthetic understanding of anything. I grew up in an environment that was probably devoid of what you would say any kind of aesthetic character, but was very, very rich socially. So, you know, it was a working class neighborhood. A lot of us were in the streets. I get part of it was the time. I grew up in, you know, inner city Montreal. And I make this joke that the only museum I had been to by the time I was 20 was Madame Tussauds Wax Museum. So I didn't understand.
By the way, that's a good one to miss.
Exactly. Although today it's kind of camp, right? It's the kind of thing that you should go to. I was good in art. I was good in science. You know, I always wanted to do something that differentiated me for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And nobody knew what architecture was in where I grew up. Like nobody knew what an architect was, that's for sure. And so that's what I did. I mean, I pursued that. Had I known what the culture of architecture studio would have been like, I would have selected that. But nobody knew that. I mean, it's collaborative. You're all working in a kind of, you know, cauldron together all the time. You're social, you're doing rigorous work, it's experimental. I had no idea that that was part of the culture. And I think that's what also people don't know, and they get into it and don't realize that's not going to work for them.
Right.
It's not just the product, it's the process itself is so profound.
The process itself is extremely profound.
Yeah.
And if you don't like process, it is not the career for you.
Correct.
Yeah.
And you have to always, it's all about self-discipline and when you cut off that, there's no answer. So because there's no answer, you can continue to design, you can throw something out, you start all over again. I mean, I know it's frustrating when you're a client because you've got a designer that's going, wait, I have another idea.
One more thing I want to play with. So just walk us through your career evolution because, you know, you have been in a variety of things and now you're, you know, running Pratt. I'm sure all these dots have connected, but, you know, you left that middle class area and went on to college. And was it there where you started diving into the world of art?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was always making things. And I should say, although my father was a laborer in a factory, he made purses. So he was a craftsman. Mm-hmm. I mean, so he could probably make anything. My mother started off in a factory sewing, ultimately became a salesperson, but she also was always making things, whether it was knitting or sewing or, you know, so it was present, although I wouldn't have seen it as something that was part of the culture. I would say that even by the time I was 17 and getting into college, I loved meeting people. If they didn't intimidate me, they were smarter than me. And I probably, my superpower was the ability to find genius in somebody else and connect it with somebody else who was also a genius in a different domain. And I remember people asking me what I wanted to do when I grew up. And at this time, I said I was going to be an architect, but I was going to be a lunar architect. Because again, that would really differentiate me, whatever that was. But I also said I want to be the head of a think tank. And of course, you know, today you would say,
yeah, you are.
Exactly, exactly. What is a president but the head? But so was a dean. To be honest, so was a faculty member.
Yes.
And all of those positions were about exploring and experimenting and opening up questions that you didn't have answers to. So I think that that may have always, in some ways, been present, even though I couldn't have articulated it in the same way.
Right. But is typical of someone who would be 17 years old.
Right. And I was also, even though I had relatively high anxiety, it was also a very high overachiever. So I did architecture and engineering with a diploma in business at the same time. So I graduated in multiple domains simultaneously. And then I started teaching immediately. I was teaching at night. I worked during the day, taught at night. And then there was a recession. And all of a sudden, I didn't work during the day. And my teaching exploded. I was now able to teach in multiple schools, from McGill to community college to private college. Anyway, one thing led to another. I realized I better get a graduate degree, even though I knew nobody who had a graduate degree. And I was at McGill University, and most of my faculty had bachelor's degrees. They were practicing architects. But so it wasn't a culture of going on to do graduate work. And my parents, my mother didn't finish eighth grade and my father didn't finish second grade. Well, he finished second grade, I think. So there was certainly not a culture of, I mean, nobody went to high school in my family. Now, I should explain that my brother, who followed me, went on to do a PhD in chemical engineering and is also a faculty member. So that's really fascinating that out of our little family.
You both went into higher education.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it's not surprising that your work sort of focuses on these pedagogical models, right? That are multidisciplinarian, right? Because your entire career from the time that you began in school is multidisciplinarian, right? And right. So you brought that to what you're doing now.
Correct. And it was always there. It was always there. From the first gig I had teaching, I was teaching structures and construction and steel and concrete while I was a design professor. It was always present. And I worked also with dancers. I built large-scale dance installations. So I crossed into other disciplines. And most recently, the dance installations were connected to dancers with disabilities. So then thinking about broadening the communities in which I worked, these were all progressions that were quite seamless.
Right. So this technology part of your brain that melds so beautifully with this artistic part of your brain, right? So allows you to think like that. I mean, what is your advice to your students as they go through the curriculum in regards to like, I want to go this path, and you're just like, no, you need to think about this path.
So I think it's all of those things, exactly as you said it. Some of it is, how do you stay open? But also to recognize if you have a particular ability, that you want to go with that ability because it reinforces you in some way. It isn't a self-reliance, although when I look through my own history, I was terrified of asking for help, terrified of asking questions, terrified of a lot of things. As I moved up the ranks when I was younger, I had no problem asking questions. But I have to tell you, as a working class kid that was a little bit scrappy, many of my faculty members, whether there was either in elementary and college, people would just say, you have too many questions, just stop asking them. And at a certain point, you stop asking.
Do you think that's a female thing? I mean, I've read so many books as well, I'm sure as you have, is that you're in the front of the class, me. And then at one point, you move to that back of the class and stop asking those questions.
So, you know, it's interesting that you say that because I've thought about this many, many times. I actually think it was the working class background that people responded to even more. This kind of kid from the streets asking too many questions. I didn't put that all together until many years later when I was at McGill and didn't recognize that most people did not come from the environment that I came from. I mean, certainly in architecture, because architecture, you know, even in Canada, is in some way seen as an elite arena.
Well, don't you think art school is often associated with elite? When you think about that, like, how do you make Pratt more accessible and equitable for all, particularly, you know, in the undergraduate, it seems to be a little different, but when you get to the graduate, right, that's a whole other story.
There's so many things here. I would say a significant one is when a student comes to a place like Pratt, how do we network them into the larger, you know, cultural partners that they're going to need later? So our students come out and they are ready to go. You say their heads are in the clouds, their feet are on the ground. They have absolutely very, very rigorous skills. So when they walk into an office, they walk into a practice, they walk into any domain, any filmmaking arena, they know how to use cutting edge technologies right away. But they also have been brought along to be big thinkers, mm-hmm. ask big questions. That combination of skills that doesn't exist in a lot of places. It does exist in art and design schools. I would say that that kind of rigor and praxis. So you see in liberal arts schools, they're trying to embed some of those things, like what pragmatic skills do you have when you leave and you have a very critical mind? This is how places like Pratt, their origin was based in being able to make things right away and then build a rounder education around asking bigger questions. So I think thinking about professional practice, how do we prepare things? We have a new minor in entrepreneurial studies, which is, I think, you know, a little bit of that. I think the larger condition is that so many of our faculty are working artists, designers, architects, information scientists, and, you know, connected to a world of practice. So they bring that.
And do you think that's much more progressive learning that should be, and I believe should be tied to the art world, where you have to really understand how you break something down to put it back together versus this concept of like memorization for the test?
Well, we all know, I think, certainly as people who are involved in education, I mean, the dilemma is when you give somebody a problem that can be solved by just checking the back of the book. These open-ended questions, especially when you think about the moment we're in right now with COVID, that everything is upended. What we have to prepare young people for everywhere, wherever they are, is to be able to be flexible, to be agile, but also to have something solid they can stand on as they move forward. Because you just can't be thrust into an environment with nothing to hold on to. You do need some kind of solid firmament that can take you into that arena. So we, of course, art and design schools have always been working in the unpredictable. I don't think anybody expected this level of unpredictability.
No, certainly. And how have you, as an educational, artistic place, managed to pivot Pratt into this learning style, which is so creative and thoughtful, into this remote sort of learning, and having all of these professors where many of them do other things besides just teach?
Right. Well, I thought you actually started the question with the answer. It's a kind of profound immersive education. Well, it's still a profound immersive education. And in fact, even in preparing for this, I know what's going on. I wanted real examples of what's happening in the classroom. And I will say the faculty, the chairs, the deans are so moved by the willingness of the students and themselves, to be honest, to try completely new things. If we think about fashion, for example, we outfitted studios with cameras and new machines so the faculty could prepare videos where you actually saw the work in situ, in real time, and questions being asked at that moment. What we're also seeing is that often the kid at the front of the class, you know, who always asks questions and monopolizes everything, well, actually, in these new formats, there are kids who are shyer who could enter things through the chat. They could speak. They have other ways of showing their work. One of the chairs in fine arts was saying to me, when we review the work, it used to be that it's right in that moment. So you have this, you know, jury looking at the work. and the work is posted. And in that moment, the jury starts speaking and there isn't a time for reflection. Well, now the students post early. You can look at the work. There's an opportunity for a level of engagement we couldn't have before. The other is that, of course, people can join us from all over the world. We can bring in reviewers that are in New Zealand or in Ghana and come to review work that
That's amazing.
Never happened before. The experiments, again, that both our faculty and our students are doing in managing these technology, I mean, these are experimenters. That's what they do.
And is it going to stay? Yeah. Do you see this staying? Because, you know, what you talked about, the student that's always like takes over the entire classroom. I have witnessed that in board meetings, particularly where there's 30 people around the table for large nonprofits, or even 7 people around the table for like private companies. And I find, even though how much longer can you do Zoom every day, there is something about those meetings that people who usually say nothing end up actually really getting engaged in a different manner. And I'm sort of fascinated by it.
I think this is a very big learning opportunity for us, is, you know, people thinking about post-COVID. What are the things that we'll hold on to, and what are the things we're going to let go? What will we say, you know what, we didn't need to do it that way? And some of it is successive, right? What are the ways that we could actually be managing and reach people, of course, who couldn't have been reached before, whether they're already in the class or they could never, never access an education like this, whether it's in continuing education or in certificates or coming in at times where things are not synchronous, so they can, if they can't do anything until midnight because they have so many other obligations, that they can join at that particular moment. There's so many emergent things. Again, I have had many of my faculty present to our board the new technologies and new systems that they're putting together in order to enable what we call embodied learning, immersive learning. And the students are doing physical things while now have a rich tapestry of tools that they didn't have before. Now, maybe too many, and there's going to be some editing about which tools work and which tools, you know, are better. And some, of course, are being designed right now. One of the, you know, and I said to students, don't take a gap year, because this year will be explosive. And you want to be at the front end of developing new platforms for delivering art design education. You want to be part of that. But you also want to be part of changing our cities, getting ready for a transformation, right? That's going to happen. We talked right at the beginning about how do we set up more equitable worlds at this point. And what this moment has shown us, even though many of us, certainly in our arenas, have been aware of the inequities that existed, this is a really profound time to, it's
right there,
accelerated.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. And do you see that you will, it is a time where education could so dramatically change into this blended learning, and even from, you know, elementary school all the way to PhD programs, and you think about these brick and mortar locations that are spending so much money on a building that can't even handle Wi-Fi, or a custodian group of people, or these unions, or all these things that drain on city budgets or state budgets. And are there people thinking about how we can reconsider education, that it becomes a more equality when it comes to learning, and that the ones that are going to shine because they can shine in different ways?
Well, it's complicated. I think if I put on a completely different hat, I put my architect hat on, and of course we design space, right? So the question is, what kind of space?
Right.
And right now, everybody is looking at that. What space is critical? We know what we're missing, right? People are missing the, again,
Social is social. Exactly. You know? That, and particularly when you're younger, that is extremely important.
Right. The touching, right? Mm-hmm. Touching. Are we giving up one of our haptic arenas? What are senses? I mean, that's the issue, is that some of it has been, again, edited out. So I think that what's going to happen is there's going to be very, very critical evaluation at a very local level. Many of the staff who said, I could never work from home. We could never do this. So COVID, of course, forced our hand. We could never have had this revolution, this transformation over a period of literally 3 months. In fact, 2 weeks when we had to do it in March.
Oh, yeah.
Flip everything. And people saying, I can't do it, to, oh, yeah, I actually can do it. And it created new bonds and new communities because everybody was learning together. Can you imagine to have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of teachers and faculty members who now have to learn together? And we saw people partnering across different domains and young people helping more mature people who thought they couldn't do it and say, I'm going to help. I'm going to make this work and shepherd collectively. I mean, it was incredible. It is incredible. And that's online. So I think that it will build sets of communities that when coming together, how we come together, when we come together, will be very, obviously, we don't want it always to be precious and planned, because the whole thing, you know, that's so wonderful is the unpredictable, right? The capriciousness of bumping into somebody generates something that we haven't yet figured out in technology. You don't just bump into somebody. It's much more programmed. There is some bumping, but
I guess, where do you see Pratt as you think, and I'm sure there's so many things going through your head about where are we going? What's the next stage? Now that we have been forced to change the way that we are having education and pods and conversations and everything, like what are your goals for Pratt?
Well, there's so many. There's the structural, there's the content. So much is going on. If we just think about who our students should be, what is the student of the future? And we've been watching that the numbers of students from, you know, 18 to 22, they're going to go off a cliff soon, and we should be prepared for that. But we also know there's a lot of people who would love to access education, and now they can, right? So whether you have low residency, high residency, you have new kinds of partnerships, they could be with small businesses, they could be with corporations, they could be with industries that you couldn't imagine before. There's the possibilities rethinking international relationships, because we don't know what the relationship to places like China will be, not because of us necessarily, but now because of China.
Yes.
And then the whole relationship to professional practice. So there's all of that to look at. What should be online? What should be hybrid? What should be face-to-face? And what programs now are going to have legs that you never imagined having legs? So a lot of evaluation going around there. So we started 133 years ago with really serving the local community. A lot of schools did that, whether, you know, it was us and Cooper and ultimately actually Stanford, IIT, Carnegie Mellon. Those schools actually copied Pratt's model, which was to build a professional class in the arena in which you sat, right? In this case, in Brooklyn. And over the years, we became a very, very high-performing, high-ranking art and design institution as well. And I think the opportunity for us is, how do you actually navigate being a world-class institution and build the strength of the community around you? So that is who we are. We have the Pratt Center for Community Development, which is almost 65 years old. Actually, it is the longest-running community design center connected to a university in the country. And why it's successful is because it's been there for a long time. And when the Pratt Center makes a commitment to a community, it's a commitment for a long time. It's not a studio project. You go in, you dabble, you show them a new way you can deal with the sidewalk and extending your restaurant. It's actually something that looks deep down about how do you build equitable communities. Amazing, amazing projects. And the students become policymakers. They become council people. They're working with those neighborhoods forever. It's really,
really pretty incredible.
Profound. Right. Yeah, pretty incredible. I mean, these are the things that we do. We do things like land value recovery and the equitable city. We do things looking at how do we help small businesses? How will they make it through this? And so we do this at the school, at the Pratt Center. But we also, we're building a research yard at the Navy Yard. And that also is working with STEM kids so that we actually start to see a continuity between art, design, and engineering and math. And we don't see these as distinct arenas.
I totally agree. They are not distinct. They are 100% wed.
But going back to a question you asked me before, people have tendencies. Some people have a technical, it just automatic. You know, they could put a stereo together. Stereo. They can take apart a car, and that's what they love to do. And the question is, how do you use those ways of engaging to look at different kinds of practices? For our artists, we are actually trying to get them to understand certain kinds of technologies that would liberate them from particular kinds of practices. And they want to do it, right? And if you make it a fun and learning environment and not one that's being judged, they'll do it. So they don't have to be afraid of asking questions. And that goes right back to my own fear of asking those questions probably stopped certain kinds of experiments that could have been extraordinary. And I had to wait until I was in my 50s and 60s. You know, I've been in many institutions. So you asked about my trajectory. It seems like it was really linear. You know, I was a faculty member, and then I was an associate dean. I was an acting dean. I was a dean. I was an acting provost. I was provost. I was president. It's almost like, but each one of them was really profound for me and littered with issues and opportunities. I will say what I realize right now, which I would not have had access before. I've been thrown into breakout rooms with really smart faculty members. I guess they all are. And
they must all.
Oh my God. But to be at Pratt in a place where everybody is creative, everybody is, you know, is such a gift. I can't even tell you, but they're not only, it's not so much that they're creative and they're talented, they're intellectually generous and compassionate. And this moment in time has called upon those deepest reserves of an incredible, incredible group of people. I think it's everywhere. I don't believe that this is.
I agree with you. I think that it is called upon people, something within, particularly in the education world, to rise to this occasion and really the ones that are participating in it on a daily basis to think, okay, this actually is really different and really novel. And we are now in a different world. And how am I going to be part of this? And how am I going to help take it forward?
Yeah. I mean, one of the questions we're always asked is going back to your question about what's higher ed. We have a K-12 program, the Saturday art program, where almost 500 kids a year come through our program.
I did not know that. That's super cool.
There you go. And it's existed for over, I think, 110 years.
Wow.
A new program. So it's basically, it's on Saturday for young kids. It also, if you're a scholar in the program, but 10, 11, 12th grade, it's also Wednesdays and Saturdays. It has incredible kids, many of them from the neighborhood and from New York City Housing Authority, and it's a way for them to explore art and design that, you know, Tom Main is the critic for architecture right now, who's, you know, comes from LA and has done extraordinary work. And so they have access to some of the most profound brains in the country, but now in the world because of this. And right now, of course, they're not coming into the campus. We have to deliver it to them. And so in some ways, again, the dilemma going back to the shifting of what will school look like is we've got to figure out how to build equitable communities, because there are children who will absolutely not thrive in the places they are. So what does it look like? Is it community centers? Is it schools like us? Are there places in every building? And I know you know very well what I'm talking about, having a collective place for people to be so that the demands of a family are not on them all the time. Because we see that with our students. We have students who are trying to do this work from home, but there's so many other tasks at home.
They become hard to get done.
It's hard.
That's really interesting. I mean, you know, these kids should have the same opportunities as everyone else. And because of COVID, in many ways, they can get that access. The issue is these buildings don't even have Wi-Fi, which is the whole thing in itself, because of the way they're built. I think we should like take them all down to its foundation and rebuild them to be buildings that are completely carbon neutral, that have Wi-Fi, that are their own electrical stations that they can sell back to the grid, and all of these different things, and have access for these children, because then they can start buying into the system. And so maybe a big idea, but that you have these programs are so great. And I'm sure that most people, I mean, I didn't even know about them. And my daughter would have benefited from them when she was a young artist.
You know, we have a School of Architecture, but in it, we also have planning and public policy, which is really looking at much larger conditions of infrastructure, implementation, the social condition. And one of the things that Pratt and many schools, of course, do is we no longer come in as we know the answer. We are deeply embedded in the communities that are engaged in that life at this moment. So we have people writing papers, what happened in Industry City or Amazon? How do you get the community to have a voice? And not as Adam Friedman, who runs our Pratt Center now, we're not anti-business. We actually want to do this in a fair way that allows the resources of the city and the country to be distributed in a way that everyone has a value. Yeah. Everyone, you know, has an impact.
And from the artists to the architects to the engineers, and everyone has an impact and a say regardless of where you came from.
Well, exactly. And in fact, if you don't, we know those projects fail, right?
They always fail. Just like companies that have no diversity around the table never get to where they could be.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, diversity. So a place like Pratt, which is dominated generally, predominantly women. And I was looking back at my own history of who's at the table, who's getting to speak. And you asked me the question at the beginning about women's voices, girls' voices versus, again, I didn't pay attention to it. I started to notice it many, many, many years later. Again, probably in my 40s, in the very moments where I would say something and nobody paid any attention. And then 15 minutes later, you know, some guy would say, and I would say, I thought I said that, but no, maybe I didn't. And to be aware of that. But I think that in a place like Pratt, I don't see that kind of dissonance. I'm sure everybody has horrific stories and we can remember these anecdotes, but we are moving forward. I think we are.
I think.
But also this particular moment in time, of course, we became very aware that we have not listened to certain voices. So at Pratt, you probably have heard, you know, decolonize, you know, a museum, decolonize, any kind of sort of standards. And it's certainly at a place like Pratt, this has been going on for years, looking at how do we change our curriculum so that it isn't reflective of only a singular viewpoint.
Yes.
And we bring in multiple ways of looking. And again, the fact that we're now online, we can bring in people we could never have brought in before because they're anchored in communities far away from us.
I thought this was all going to happen 30 years ago. It just took a little longer. But I do believe that, as you do, we are at a moment of time that we're moving into a more equitable time period.
I think this is that moment. We have to hold on to it because we watch things dissipate very quickly. We have a lot of energy about something and then it sort of vanishes. I think one of the roles of higher education, because our students come in and they leave after two, three, four, five years, our job as faculty, as fundamentally stewards of the institution, is to build in a landscape that has gravitas and sustainability.
Yes.
Our job is to make sure we carry their voices.
Great. Well, thank you so much for doing this today.
Absolutely.
You enlivened me of a day of hell.
I really appreciate this too.
Great. And always silver linings when there's darkness.
Absolutely. And even, you know, for our artists, it's even though it's a downtime for them, it actually has given them time to do their work.
For sure.
And what emerges now in this moment, we have no idea. I mean, remember, surrealism, Dada, these things all came after crises.
Yes.
We'll see something that we cannot predict that's going to be unbelievable. I tell my students, I said, don't look in the moment, just be in the moment and let's talk in 2040. Let's get back together.
Totally. And by the way, we should all be in the moment right now.
To learn more about Pratt, you can visit the website at pratt.edu. A little gem in Brooklyn, New York. Our next guest on Positively Gotham Gal will be Sarah Irvani, the CEO of a family-owned and operated made-in-America shoe company, Okabashi.